From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. For years, the term deep state was the purview of fringe activists on the right and the left, used to refer to the invisible aspects of governance and policy controlled by America's vast and powerful intelligence agencies. Since Donald Trump's presidency, that phrase has entered the mainstream lexicon, primarily because Trump himself uses it to promote the idea that intelligence officials are secretly working behind the scenes to undermine him. It doesn't help that agencies like the FBI and CIA have a sordid and well-documented history of violating rights and pushing the envelope of legality. My guest today is David Rode, two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, and a former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. He was captured by the Afghan Taliban more than 10 years ago and held for many months before escaping and reporting on the Afghan war. His new book is called In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Sonali.
So what does Trump mean specifically when he uses the term deep state? He tweets it all the time. Does he specify what this term means to him?
It's changed over time. Initially, he used the deep state when he was sort of referring to the FBI investigation of his campaign's ties with Russia. He also applied it to CIA officials. It's grown, though. He at one point, he was pushing for an American Special Forces soldier to not be tried by the U.S. military for war crimes. And then he sort of declared the Pentagon at that time part of the deep state. And more recently, Trump himself has not used the term, but many of his supporters have accused Dr. Tony Fauci, one of the country's leading infectious disease experts, of being a member of the deep state as well. And they accuse him of exaggerating the threat of coronavirus as a way to undermine the economy and the president's reelection chances. So part of the reason I wrote the book is because there's no one's clear sort of what exactly the term means, and many people, including the president, use it in different ways.
Where did the term originate? Obviously, Trump didn't come up with it. I mentioned that it's been a favorite of, you know, conspiracy theorists on the right and on the left. Is it a uniquely American term?
No, it was actually first used to describe the military in Turkey. And political scientists use it to talk about the tendency of the military there to try to block the development of democracy in the country. Some people applied it to the military in Egypt as well. And the first, example I could find of it being used in the United States was actually by an academic in California, Peter Dale Scott. He's a retired professor from the University of UC Berkeley. And in a 2007 book, Scott applied the term deep state for the first time, as far as I could tell, to the American government. And he came from more of a critique from the left. Scott argued that the American deep state, and he defined it as sort of military contractors, generals. He also talked about it as financial interests on Wall Street, had pushed the U.S. into endless wars and before and after 9/11. So he used it in his book. But again, he was coming more from the left perspective of the military-industrial complex.
So if we focus on the definition, at least Trump's definition of the deep state, including or encompassing today's intelligence agencies, I want to ask you to lay out for those who, aren't scholars of the American government system, what the relationship is supposed to be between agencies like the FBI, the CIA, which of course under the FBI being under the purview of the Justice Department, and the White House, the executive branch. The president is supposed to appoint heads of these agencies, but there's supposed to be a firewall between them, right? They're supposed to be independent.
They're supposed to be independent, and we can talk about this more, but there was a series of investigations in the 70s by Congress, and there was a decision that it was very important that the FBI and the CIA, given their power, not be used for political purposes by presidents. And it was also, you know, deemed that FBI officials and CIA operatives, you know, would not be distorting the information that they were providing to the president. And the reason for this is that many of our sort of biggest intelligence debacles, anywhere from the Bay of Pigs to the Iraq invasion in 2003, came about when, you know, intelligence analysts were sort of telling presidents what they wanted to hear. Part of those reforms also was that there would be oversight of these agencies by Congress as well. In the late 70s, after these abuses were found, new intelligence were intelligence committees were created in Congress, in the House, and the Senate. A new system was created where the president, instead of, you know, the president would have sort of a verbal communication with the CIA director about, you know, covert action programs the U.S. was carrying out. After these reforms, the president had to sign a written covert action finding. That document was then given to the heads of both parties in Congress. And there was also a ban on the U.S. carrying out assassinations, the CIA carrying out assassinations abroad, or CIA agents posing as journalists. And lastly, the judicial branch was involved as well. A special court was created, the FISA court, to monitor efforts by the FBI to surveil Americans as part of counterterrorism or counterintelligence investigations. And so the goal was to have overlapping oversight. You'd have a president overlooking the agencies, and you'd also have Congress and the courts as well.
So we are in a place now where President Trump has, you know, conveniently used this idea that these intelligence agencies are working against him to undermine legitimate investigations of how his campaign conducted itself, of how he has how he and his colleagues have conducted themselves during his presidency. It's a very convenient ruse, and his base seems to buy it. It's also one that's promoted by Fox News, right?
It is, and I'm going to try to be the, if it still exists these days, the sort of more non-partisan journalist. Look, there is no question, as you said at the very beginning of the interview, there's a long history of CIA and FBI abuses. What did change with these reforms in the 70s is the misconduct that's happened since then. It's usually been at the direction of presidents. George W. Bush, you know, told the CIA to carry out rendition and torture. George W. Bush, you know, told them to carry out warrantless mass surveillance. President Obama, you know, carried out a record number of drone strikes around the world to counter terrorism. So the idea of these rogue agencies, that really hasn't happened in the last 40 years. And I essentially came to the conclusion that the term deep state is political rhetoric. I don't like it. I think it's, you know, it's inaccurate. It sounds like a conspiracy. If you really like government, you know, a term you could use that I think is also political rhetoric would be like good government. I think there's a permanent government. I use the term institutional government. We have these institutions that continue to function no matter who's president. But what's different is, you know, every president has come to Washington and complained about these institutions, these bureaucrats. They'd say, you know, they leak stories. You know, but what I found is that the loyalty of most career civil servants is to their institution. They will leak stories to influence policy. They'll fight for turf or bigger budget. You know, Ronald Reagan came to Washington and complained the State Department was, you know, not implementing his tough on communism policy. Barack Obama came to Washington. He was suspicious of the Pentagon. He thought Pentagon generals were leaking large proposed troop increases in Afghanistan to force Obama to send a large number of troops. But, you know, I found no evidence of a deep state, of a coup, you know, a plot against President Trump. I think he's, you know, he's exaggerating what's happening, and he's using he uses the term very effectively to discredit enemies. Any sort of officials who question him or contradict his political messages, you know, are declared members of the deep state.
And on the contrary, now his Justice Department, and I say his because Attorney General William Barr has acted more often like the president's personal attorney than the than the nation's attorney general. Trump's Justice Department seems to be engaged in a very overt conspiracy to punish anybody who has tried to investigate Trump. Anybody who was involved in not just the special counsel's investigation, but also the impeachment proceedings, the initial whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment articles around the involvement with the Ukraine government. That's all out in the open, right? Let's talk about William Barr and the role that he has played.
So Barr is a central character in the book. And long before, Donald Trump was running for president, Barr felt that these reforms that were enacted in the 70s were excessive. He felt that they gave Congress and the courts too much power. Barr was one of a number of conservatives who felt that the presidency was weakened too much in the wake of Watergate. Other people who agreed with him were two aides to President Ford. They were very young at the time, but that was Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And Antonin Scalia, who was a conservative legal scholar at the time but went on to become a Supreme Court justice, felt the same way. So Barr's worked for years. He worked in the Reagan White House. Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general, also was focused on trying to restore the power of the presidency. And this moment under President Trump, Barr has completely embraced this. He argued in a speech last fall to the Federalist Society that we need a stronger executive branch, that when you look historically at which branch of the government has saved the country when it faces natural disaster or war, or economic crises, it's been the executive branch. And so he was, Barr complained about, a federal judge in, I think, in California on the West Coast stopping President Trump's travel ban, that was an infringement on a president's power, as Barr reads the Constitution. He's criticized these investigations by Congress as overkill, and he believes special counsel should not be appointed, that again is an infringement of the power of the president to run the executive branch as he sees fit. So he's very dismissive of the Mueller investigation, and you're right, he's launched an investigation of the investigators. He's accused them of wrongdoing. He dropped the charges against Flynn. And now, other legal scholars say this is a disaster. It's rebalancing the sort of basic division of powers that's a core of our democracy, where you have three co-equal branches of government that compete with each other and act as checks on each other. So I came to the conclusion in the book that sort of under the guise of stopping a coup that doesn't really exist, Trump, with the help of Bill Barr, is sort of rebalancing the division of powers in American democracy. And it's a very stark and I think dangerous trend that's happening.
Yes, it's quite shocking. We also, there was just, as an aside, a recent interview where William Barr, when asked about his decision to drop charges against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, when he was asked how history would view his actions, he started his answer saying history is written by the winners. Let's focus also on the George W. Bush administration. Your book is about the FBI, about the CIA, and about Trump's claims of a deep state. The CIA, especially during the Bush administration, this is the second Bush administration, became an especially notorious agency, particularly around the war on terrorism. Why is this a critical part of the story?
Because the story is really the effort to control the FBI and CIA, and it starts with these reforms again in the late 70s, and Bush flouts them. He essentially says, I, as president, can carry out a mass surveillance program, and I don't need to go to this FISA court, the federal court that was created to stop abuses. And there was, very famous legal memos written by John Yoo, who was in the Justice Department at that time, authorizing the use of torture and renditions and other methods to combat terrorism. Many Americans, did support those methods. There was a huge upturn in support for a powerful presidency and for the FBI and the CIA after 9/11. But I think many people were troubled by you know, the methods that were used. Bush, once the New York Times reported the existence of the mass surveillance, it was very unpopular, and Bush ended up going to the court and getting permission. So the idea of checks and balances, of, you know, controlling a president and controlling how the CIA and FBI are used is popular in among Americans. But, you know, the president Trump has been very effective at saying, no, you know, there is the problem are these unelected officials. You know, I'm the elected president and they're, you know, trying to overthrow me. Again, I even had members of Trump's own administration agree that was an exaggeration. Again, Trump officials, I talked to Obama administration officials, Bush administration officials, Clinton administration officials, lots of frustration with the machinations of bureaucrats in Washington. But even Trump's own aides said no evidence of a coup.
How do you, as a journalist, assess the FBI's role and in intelligence community's role in trying to unearth what the Trump campaign and eventually the Trump presidency was engaged in? It was under Obama that the investigations into what Michael Flynn's, you know, what Michael Flynn did or did not do started, his connections, his contact with Russian operatives. Do you assess whether the investigation was fairly started?
I do. I partly based on there was a review by the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Horowitz, that found they were properly launched. And I interviewed James Baker. He was the general counsel of the FBI. And involved in the launch of the investigations. I didn't speak to former director Comey. And, you know, Baker stands by the launch of the investigations, and that actually occurred in July of 2016. You know, the DNC emails had been stolen and by Russia, it was believed. President Trump had publicly asked Russia at that point to find Hillary Clinton's emails. And there was this report of a Trump campaign operative, George Papadopoulos, saying that Russia had dirt on Hillary Clinton, wanted to share it, and they launched the investigation. At that point, they didn't have the dossier by Christopher Steele, much of which has proven to be false, was not instrumental to the launch of the investigation. And then as a reporter, I spent the summer of 2016 trying to confirm that the FBI was investigating Trump's campaign. You know, and the FBI refused to confirm that they were. They didn't confirm it with any journalists that summer. Again, if there was an FBI plot to derail the Trump campaign, the easiest way to do that would have been to leak the fact that they were investigating Trump. They never did that. In fact, James Comey reopened the Hillary Clinton email investigation days before the election, which hurt her. And just one other anecdote, I went to James Clapper for an interview. I was doing a story about the CIA. And I asked him about reports in the Steele dossier of, you know, that Russia had compromising videotapes of Donald Trump. This was about 6 months before the 2016 election. And I asked Brennan if he could confirm that there were such tapes. And Brennan, you know, declined to comment. He said, I'm not confirming this thing you've heard about tapes. I'm not denying this thing you've heard about tapes. I don't want to go anywhere near this. And Brennan actually urged me. He said, you're going to hear a lot of crazy things about, you know, Donald Trump over the last few weeks of the campaign and crazy things about Hillary Clinton. You know, he urged me to be more conservative than ever in terms of what I reported before the election. So I'm not saying we should trust the CIA or the FBI.
Right.
We should have very aggressive oversight by the press, by the courts, by Congress. But this talk of a plot, you know, isn't true. There was a problem that was found by the Inspector General, Carter Page. He was a former Trump campaign advisor. He was surveilled. There was a warrant obtained by the federal court, but it shouldn't have gone on for as long as it went on. The last two applications were approved, and it was egregious. There was a case where an FBI lawyer changed an email. Carter Page was under suspicion because he was meeting with Russian government officials. The email explained that Carter Page was talking to the CIA after these meetings with Russian government officials, and the email was changed to say that Page was not cooperating with the CIA when he actually was. That's egregious. You know, that should be investigated. But again, you know, so the first two applications for the several months for surveilling Page were proper, according to the Inspector General's report. The last 2 months weren't. But again, that is completely different from claiming that the FBI was secretly wiretapping Trump Tower, so, or again, talking about a coup.
There have been a number of low-level and even upper-level staffers that have either been fired or resigned from these various intelligence agencies under the Trump administration. I understand morale is quite low within these agencies. You know, there are people who have signed up publicly onto letters demanding that William Barr be held accountable for his very political and politicized decisions. What do you think the future of the intelligence community is with the Trump presidency and even past the Trump presidency? Has Trump sort of left an indelible mark on the intelligence agencies?
So I found that the FBI and CIA, the personnel were sort of just as divided as the rest of the country. Hmm. There's a, you know, group that, you know, supports President Trump and a group that doesn't like him at all. And what worried me most was that there was a great sense of alienation among folks that I talked to. They felt that the political class was sort of using the FBI and the CIA to score points increasingly when there's information that they find or a criminal case that they bring that helps, you know, either side's political narrative. It's hyped by that side. When there's, you know, information that doesn't match either side's political narrative, it's sort of downplayed or doesn't get much interest. And so there's a sense of apathy. One of the characters in the book went to the, there was a congressional hearing where John Stewart testified about first responders, you know, who were getting cancer from going to the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, not getting enough support for Congress. And I asked this person, he was an FBI agent who was retiring, you know, he was just sort of, you know, very frustrated with the political class, a pox on all their houses, again, not being Republican or Democratic. And I said, well, would you ever, you know, you're retiring, would you ever run for office? And the FBI, former FBI agent said, no, you know, I want to do something that has meaning. And that's a bad, bad sign for our democracy when there's that much alienation going on. And, you know, I wrote this book to examine one conspiracy theory and found that it wasn't true. And I just worry that we're trapped in this cycle of division and distrust and conspiracy theory that's leading us to be unable to agree on basic facts, even coronavirus and how to respond to it.
Right. The Trump administration has clashed with its own intelligence leaders around the origin of the COVID-19 virus because the intelligence community does not adopt his conspiracy theory about it being created in a lab in Wuhan, China. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book and thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you so much.
My guest has been David Rode. He's a two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. And we've been discussing his new book, In Deep, the FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.